It's a labor of love. It's a labor done because I really love doing the Berlin program.
Welcome to the Innovating Faculty-Led Programs podcast. I'm your host, Soren Peterson. My guest in this episode is Dr. Sandra Marku, director of the Margaret Sloss Center for Women and Gender Equity at Iowa State University, who directs ISU's summer program in Berlin. I met Sandra at the Iowa International Education Conference a couple of years ago, and then had the opportunity to chat with her on campus. If you listen carefully, you might even hear the bells of Iowa State Campanile in the background. Regardless of your experience or role with faculty-led programs, I invite you to join the conversation and let us know what you think about this episode. You'll hear more about that at the end of the show. Well, welcome to the podcast. Talk a little bit about how you got involved in faculty-led programs.
I got involved, or I was inspired to study abroad as a student because I participated in study abroad, which I think is pretty common and how people get into study abroad.
And where did you study abroad?
Yeah, I went abroad to Salzburg, Austria through Bowling Green State University's program. They have a fantastic program that takes students abroad for a semester or a whole year, and I went for the whole year. And then, in fact, I loved it so much that I stayed for a second year as a grad student. So I decided to quickly wrap up my undergraduate studies while abroad, just so I could stay abroad and experience another year in Austria. And while there, the way BGSU still does this today is that a faculty member goes with a student group from Ohio to Salzburg and lives there for the year, and they bring their family along. So I had two directors, for one for each year, with their families that were part of our student group. So that presented me with that idea and option that this is something I could do later in life, and even if I choose to have kids and family, mm-hmm. I could still do this. So that's what planted the seed. And then, fast forward 2 years later, I arrived here at Iowa State University, and a colleague of mine in German, and I was in the German department at the time, created this Berlin program that I now lead and wanted someone to co-direct and invited me along. And I helped with the planning, but it took a little bit for me to be able to go because we just started a family, and so I was pregnant 1 year, and then I had a newborn, and I felt like that was too soon to probably embark on this journey. And then when my kids were actually 2 and 4, we went. So I co-led this faculty-led program to Berlin, and my spouse and kids came and took 13 students that year, and then have been going ever since. And then last year I went by myself, so I took over the program and now direct it on my own.
So what was the thing that finally pulled you into doing the Berlin program?
There was no need for anything to pull me in. I was 100% on board at the mere mention of taking students to Berlin. I find that when you engage with a culture you're studying in person by immersing yourself in it, it's a very different experience from studying that culture in a book. I love literature. I have a literature degree. I love reading about things, but it's not the same as actually being there, moving through those streets, engaging with people, experiencing a culture firsthand. And I think it offers you as a traveler so many opportunities to reflect on how you move through the world and who you are, how you were socialized to look at the world. And you realize there's so many ways of seeing things that are maybe different from how you were raised. And so I wanted to keep experiencing that for myself, and I wanted to introduce that to my students.
Great. So what excites you the most about leading programs?
I love seeing students experience Berlin, especially my students here who have never left the Midwest or never left Iowa, and being there with them through that journey. It's really exciting. We have amazing conversations as a result. On our program, what we do is we study Berlin's history through architecture memorials. So the history of Berlin, specifically from rise of the Nazi regime in 1930s to the fall of the wall 1989. So that specific period in history, the way it's represented today through the built environment. So memorials, museums, landmarks. We visit all these places that communicate something about that past. And while we talk about it, we're always reflecting on what we're doing in the U.S. and how we remember American history, and what does it look like to have conversations about darker parts of history and less favorable things that have been done by governments and people. I think those conversations they're amazing, and they're critical for training students to think about issues before we send them out into the working world. And, you know, we want to prepare them to be conscious citizens.
So those conversations about darker parts of history, have those led into conversations about darker parts of U.S. history?
Always.
Always.
Always. And, you know, my colleague and I, when we were first discussing how to engage in these conversations, especially the year we went abroad, that was right around the most recent presidential election, and there was so much going on in the media around topics around different identities and who belongs in the countries and borders, and lots of those themes come up in our discussions in Berlin, especially as we're going to a very physical border, the Berlin Wall and the remnants of it. And we wondered how much should we push that comparative analysis, and we didn't need to. The students took it there. So instantly the conversation went to, oh, you know, here's how we're seeing this happening in the U.S. or how it's happened in the U.S. and how we are or not talking about it. So, and I think that's the best part, when we can use something from another culture or time period or history and reflect on it and make that connection to our everyday.
Right. I think one of the often surprising things in terms of lessons for students is they come back and they realize that they've learned something about their own culture.
Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely.
So,
yeah.
Great. So you've co-led and now led the program several times. Mm-hmm. What do you wish you had known when you started that you know now?
That is really a 24-hour job. I think when I went as a student on study abroad, I sort of romanticized what my professors did. I saw them getting to spend a whole year in Salzburg in a university-provided apartment, and thought, this is so nice. I would love to do this one day and just get to be in Austria or wherever as part of my job. And I look back now and I realize how many times we would call on them to take us to the hospital at night or to solve a crisis at a time that wasn't probably most convenient. This is something that I tell my colleagues when they ask me and they're exploring the idea of study abroad, that you have to be willing to be in it around the clock when you're there.
Right.
And that it's not uncommon to get a phone call from your students who may be traveling for the weekend and they're in another country, and they call you at 11 p.m. because they have flight emergency issues or whatever. And you're just on all the time. So that's something I didn't know, because I think we often think about the curricular part of study abroad and the course we're designing.
Yep.
I often think that people who maybe come with student affairs experiences working in residence halls or res life are probably the ones who are best equipped for this, because you're on all the time.
Right. So as an academic, you're not used to the student affairs part of the university, and yet you have to be the student affairs professional on site, right? I was going to say, having worked on site in Ecuador with study abroad programs, those emergency calls never come at a convenient time.
No, they never do.
No.
Yeah.
And from my own study abroad experience in Latin America, I remember the first program that I was on was a faculty-led program that lasted the entire quarter. And we went to five different countries. And I won't mention the year because it was so many years ago. But in those days, Ecuador had a state airline that had a kind of circular route around Latin America. And so the program was taking advantage of that. And we were... we had just loaded up the bus to go on a weekend camping trip outside of Cuenca, Ecuador. And I remember that one of the faculty members leaned out of the balcony and shouted to the other faculty members, "There's trouble in paradise." And it turned out that Ecuadoriana Airlines had changed its flight schedule and was no longer flying to Argentina, our next stop, on the day that we had planned.
Wow, okay.
And so they had to quickly... figure out if they could reshuffle the plans. And in the end, they had to end up rebooking that particular flight on the Argentinian airline. So yeah you're right. You have to be prepared to do lots of things, and usually at pretty inopportune moments. So
yeah, I think you have to be comfortable with the unknown when you're leading a study abroad trip, and comfortable with making decisions on the fly as needed. Similar kind of to your story, 2 years ago I was in Berlin, and we always take a weekend trip to Dresden, which is another city in East Germany, with our students. And we used to always go by bus and had a really cost-effective way of getting from Berlin to Dresden with a large group. And I went to buy the bus tickets at the same kiosk that I've always bought them, and I had to travel across the city of Berlin. It took me 45 minutes to get there with my three-year-old. I got there. That kiosk no longer existed. And then I asked around, and that bus line no longer existed.
Oh, no.
So, you know, I mean, when you go in the summer and there's essentially a whole year between your previous time in a city, things change. Things go out of business.
Right,
so
right.
We had to kind of last minute figure out, okay, what's our next best option? And it was not a big deal, and we figured out a train route to take, but you have to be really comfortable with, okay, I'm responsible for getting a group of X number of students from point A to B, and I have to just make a call right now on how we're going to do that.
I guess it's nice to hear that changes like that happen, not just in places like Ecuador, but...
No, they happen everywhere.
Yeah, they do.
Yeah.
Good. So you mentioned your three-year-old, and when I heard you talk about your study abroad experience leading programs at the Iowa International Education Conference recently, you talked about taking your family with you. And one of the stories that I really remember was when your kids noticed things like the stumbling stones in Berlin. Could you talk about what it's like to have your family there with you and how that's changed the experience, not just for you as a faculty leader, but maybe for the students as well?
Yeah, my kids being there offers just yet another lens on the topics we talk about. And it's not like I brought them along to be an educational tool, but they often end up sort of offering that perspective. The story I shared at the conference is of the Stolpersteine, which stumbling stones is how that translates to, which is the largest decentralized memorial in Europe, recognizing what happened to Jews, as well as other victims of the Holocaust and Nazi Germany. And so there are these little gold cobblestones that bear the name of a person who is taken from their home or place of work against their will, and usually taken to an extermination camp. And they're placed in the location where they were taken, and they say their name and their birth year and death year date if it's known, and usually the location where they were taken to. And so as you move through the city, once you notice one, you start seeing them all, and it's really horrific to keep moving through the city and keep being forced to recognize the atrocities that happened.
Right.
And, you know, you're stepping across the threshold to go into a bank, and there's that stone with somebody's name and death date. And so I think it's an incredibly effective memorial that forces you to think about history all the time, not just when you want to. And it's also... what I noticed, you know, at the conference is it's down on the ground, so kids can see it. So my kids also instantly noticed it and were asking questions about it. And I had to think sort of on my feet about how to explain this to my kids and what part of it to read to them or how to talk about it. And that led to a conversation as part of our class discussion of how German children and youth have access to these darker parts of their history just throughout the city. So in terms of your family or your teachers being presenting sort of that control that educators and parents have over knowledge, that you as a child have to you have to gain access to that knowledge through the people who are giving it to you, and their beliefs deeply inform what you learn about the world and how you view the world. How does that change when the city bears this information all around you, and you as a parent really can't control that? I mean, you're moving through the city, and your kids, as soon as they start to read, are able to read these stumbling stones, and questions will come up. And if you don't answer them, I'm sure somebody will. And so we talked about who has access to knowledge and information, how is that distributed, and how early in life you're exposed to this information about your history, which is, again, a point that's maybe different from history, how it's taught in the U.S. and there. And I think if it weren't for my kids being there and pointing that out, I don't know that we would have also gotten to these discussions around at what age do you start to have access to this information.
Right.
So, yeah.
So how did, talk more about how that, that particular situation with your kids noticing the stumbling stones, how did that change the things that the students noticed or the things that you started to point out to the students? And maybe part B of this question is, how did that particular situation perhaps translate back here to things that your kids notice here that they might not have otherwise?
I mean, I think being on this trip with me, my student, my kids, I think it does help them become more observant because we're taking time to purposefully move through a city and be super observant of the city and what we're learning from it. So it teaches you to look at your surroundings in a less distracted way. You know, as we move through Berlin and it's our class is not in a classroom, it's in the city of Berlin. You know, you're not moving through it with a certain destination in mind. It's the process of looking around and taking it in. So I think my kids are learning that and bringing that back with them. To go to the first part of your question, you know, another example where my kids sort of impacted how we as a class thought about a topic, we were at the homosexual memorial in Berlin, which pays tribute to gays and lesbians who were persecuted during the Holocaust as well. And that memorial is a large concrete box, and it has a window that you can look through and you see a film and you see same-sex couples kissing, and it just keeps playing in a loop, and there's usually a rose that's placed there. So it's a very interesting memorial, and we talk a lot about it, but there my kids came up to it, and the window to see the film is taller, higher up than what they are, so they couldn't see what all the students were seeing. So one of my students asked for permission to lift up my daughter to be able to look at the film. And I appreciated that she wanted to make sure I was okay with it. And I was like, of course you can. And but there too, we were thinking like, that's also interesting. So what are we seeing as a culture in terms of what we still find to be a taboo topic versus not? So stumbling stones are easily accessible to children low on the ground. But here, in the case of, you know, a same-sex couple kissing, it's still placed in a way where it sort of assumes a certain height and with an age that they access that film. So we talked a lot about that. And again, it, experiences that we might not otherwise have. So I think having my kids there often allows us and forces us to think about things in a different way. And then, of course, I just love having them there with me.
Great. So what advice would you give to faculty who are thinking about developing and leading a program?
It's a huge time commitment, and you have to be okay. If you're someone who likes your space and privacy at the end of the day, then I don't know that taking a group of students abroad is the thing for you. You might just want to go on a trip abroad on your own. But I think, you know, just planning is important, but as we noted earlier, that flexibility when you arrive and being able to go with the flow. And increasingly, I find myself talking to colleagues about what it means to create programs where your family can come with you. I think that when we're thinking of study abroad as something that should be, you know, so when we're thinking about faculty-led programs and we envision just a faculty member going without their family, it creates a dynamic where only certain people can do that. If you have dependents, if you're a caregiver, you're likely not going to be able to consistently sustain a study abroad program that takes you out of the country if it means time away from a family. And traditionally, what I've seen within faculty-led programs is that there's a gender imbalance. It's easier for men to take off and leave their families or children behind because women traditionally are the caregivers of children. And so it also creates this sort of imbalance on who can go abroad and who's represented in those spaces. So I have been very vocal and visible about my children being there and that it doesn't detract from my ability to be a professional or to be a faculty member or to lead students. It's that I think I'm modeling to my students too that your identity is made up of multiple complex parts and you don't always have to separate and hide them. You can find ways to bridge them, and I think it can it can lead to richer experiences for everyone. So I think more conversations about how we're bringing the personal into the work we do abroad is something that I would like to see us continue to have in the field.
Great. So how has your experience leading programs abroad translated into the teaching and the work that you do here on campus?
That's a great question. I have thought more about how we can offer experiences outside of the classroom to our students right here, because I recognize that not everyone can go abroad. Right, obviously, going abroad is also a privileged experience, and we know that as professionals in the study abroad field. And our Berlin program that we created, my colleague and I were very intentional about trying to make it as affordable and accessible to students as possible. And still, there are students who may not be able to go abroad for many reasons, personal reasons, not just financial reasons. And so I've thought more and more about how can we use the community right here to sort of still create these experiential learning opportunities for students. So for a Global Borders course I co-taught a couple of semesters ago, that meant engaging our university museum educators and taking a tour of all the statues on campus, and especially looking for ones that dealt with themes of borders, and bringing in a tour guide from the museum who knows a lot more about these works of art than we as instructors did, to take our students around and to talk about the artists, the work, and then we were able to bring that into our conversation, which was a little bit like what we do in Berlin, and I was able to create it right here on campus.
Right.
So it's made me think more creatively and outside of the box about my teaching.
Great. So it sounds like you're pretty established with the Berlin program. If you had an opportunity to create a new faculty-led program somewhere else in the world, where would that be? And what would the course be?
Oh, that's a great question. I have thought about this. Obviously, you always kind of think of the places that you know well, because it seems easiest to take students on a journey through a place where you feel like you're comfortable and can lead them through it. And so for me, those are parts of Germany and Austria, and southern Germany and Austria. So I think it would be really exciting to do something in Munich or Salzburg, because I know those places well. Mm-hmm. But I've also thought about what it might look like to create a program in Romania, which is my birth country.
Right.
That's where I was born and lived until I was 7, and spent pretty much every summer until high school. And I guess maybe I don't know this, but it seems superficially, not having looked at the data, that we have fewer programs going to Eastern Europe than we have Western Europe.
I think that's true.
Is that fair to say? Yeah, is that a fair assessment?
That's absolutely fair to say.
Okay, so I think rather than maybe creating yet another program to Germany, what I should be thinking about is creating something to Romania and Eastern Europe. There's a lot there to be studied and explored, and yeah, that would be super interesting and fun for me to do.
So how would you convince students to go to a more non-traditional location like Romania?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't know. I guess.
Or perhaps more importantly, how would you convince their parents that it would be okay to go?
I mean, the cliche thing is to slap a picture of Dracula on a flyer, because I feel like that's the only thing people know of Romania, is that Transylvania is in Romania, and it has that folklore and the mythology that people are familiar with. But truly, Romania is a beautiful country with lots of mountains and extremely, extremely beautiful nature. And so I think visuals bring people in. We use a lot of visuals to attract people to Berlin. So I would lead with that and follow up with conversations with parents and families around, I don't know. I mean, I think what parents and families want to know is that their students are safe with you. And I don't think that there are safety concerns for Romania, especially since Romania has joined the EU, that would make it a more uniquely, I don't know, dangerous or unlikely destination from Western Europe, I think. But I think it's the unknown, and Eastern Europe is still part of that other unknown that we don't go to as often.
Right.
I don't know if that answered the question.
Yeah, I think it did.
Okay.
Is there a colleague or department on campus that is not currently involved in faculty-led programs that you'd really love to see involved? And how might you approach that conversation?
Oh, that's a fascinating question. Um, I wonder, I don't know. We have a ton of study abroad programs at Iowa State, so I really can't say with certainty what departments haven't, aren't offering programs to their students. One department that I'm wondering about is early childhood ed and just teacher education programs. Mm-hmm. Having worked with students here on campus, having known students who are training to become teachers, both teachers of world languages or in other areas, they all do their classroom placement before getting mm-hmm. certified to teach. I don't know that many of them go abroad as part of their training and preparation unless they so seek out to do. I think people who are entrusted with educating our children should be people who have these international experiences, who learn to look at the world not just in the way they were raised, who are comfortable with people from other countries and cultures, who are sensitive to people who come from different backgrounds and identities. I think it would be amazing if we put increased emphasis on having future teachers also have access to these international opportunities.
Great. And then what if a faculty member from, say, a university in Romania said, I'd like to bring a group of my students to Ames, Iowa. Mm-hmm. What would you suggest that they do? Or how would you approach that particular thing from the other end?
That would be super exciting. I think that would be really fun. We have, when I was part of World Languages and Cultures, which is a department that I started in here at Iowa State, we would host students, visiting students all the time. And in fact, we've even hosted students who were not native English speakers, and with the aid of interpreter, were able to take them around campus. These were Spanish-speaking students, and that was a really fun experience. So we obviously have an office for this on campus, an International Students and Scholars office that hosts international students and scholars. But I think if I were approached about it, I would just be super excited to get to host someone from my home country here. And would probably just want to like create an itinerary and host them and do something around that. I think one thing that's really exciting about ISU is that people seem to be really on board with being innovative and collaborative. So when you pitch an idea to a colleague or a department, I've gotten more yeses than nos during my time here.
Wonderful.
I think people tend to say, sure, let's see if we can make that happen. So I could see pitching the idea of hosting a group and people being really excited to welcome them to campus.
Right. Now, going back to the Berlin program, as I recall, you make all of the arrangements for yourself. Could you talk more about the workload and how you manage that when you also have a full-time job here on campus that you also have to do?
Mm-hmm. It's a labor of love. It's a labor done because I really love doing the Berlin program, and it does end up being, it's not just work while you're there, but it really is year-round in securing housing for your students and writing out the itinerary. And there are certain things that you have to make reservations to be able to visit, like the German Parliament building. You have to schedule that visit months in advance and submit everyone's passport information to be able to gain entrance. So you really have to be organized year-round and plan for things. And also, a lot of work goes into recruiting students. I don't know that we talk about that a lot.
That's a great subject. Let's talk more about recruitment and marketing.
I feel like there's the month in Berlin, and then there are the other 11 months where you're recruiting and planning to go. And the recruitment piece is something that I don't know that we talk enough about, because that plays a large role, especially at institutions like ISU, where you are competing with so many programs. So it's not enough to offer the program. Students don't just like see your program offered and can't wait to sign up. You mm-hmm. have to convince them that your program will offer them something that maybe another program does not.
Right. And so how involved are you in the marketing and recruitment?
I feel like I do most of it. And I don't know what that looks like at other institutions, but Here, I have a lot of behind-the-scenes support from our study abroad office in terms of listing the program online. And once students apply, their application process and getting their insurance and all the pre-departure checklist, mm-hmm. there's a lot of support for that. But in terms of getting that student to click the submit button on an application, I do everything from doing classroom visits, so going to classes where students are studying the subjects I think relate to what we would be doing, and recruiting students, sending tons of emails out to colleagues, advisors, telling them about the program, asking them to share the info, creating all the visual content like the brochure, flyers, social media stuff. We've created short videos of our program while in Berlin that we can use to tell students visually what they will experience. Tabling at the study abroad fair. And we often, what I think is really very effective is we engage students from previous years to come and talk to their peers in the classroom or at the study abroad fair, because when students hear from other students, they're more likely to be convinced than when they hear from us who created a program that we think it's a great program.
Right.
There's so much that goes into recruitment, and you have to make a certain number of students, right, to be able to take mm-hmm. your group abroad. So you are always balancing that desire to keep the group manageable and small while also needing to take a certain number of students for the program to run. That part is very time intensive and can feel like a lot when you're doing that on the side throughout the year while also doing, you know, your other job. But again, it's a labor of love. You do it because you believe in the program and what you're offering students, and because what you feel like you're promoting has value. You're not just saying it.
Right. So how do you think that the marketing and recruitment is different when you do it versus when, say, the study abroad office does it?
When I'm talking about the program, I'm talking very specifically about here's what it looks like to be with me in Berlin throughout the city and what you might experience and what a typical day looks like. Here's what, from the moment you wake up until we maybe say goodbye after dinner, what you might be encountering and experiencing. I think that's harder for someone to describe who hasn't been there, mm-hmm. Which is why we also recruit students from previous years who want to help us promote the program to their peers.
Right.
We've never had a problem getting students to want to do that. Most of our students come back and they love the program and they stay in touch with us.
The problem is probably getting the students to stop talking about the experience.
Yes, no, absolutely.
Right.
We've had amazing students, alum of the program, who have done so much in keeping it going for us. I welcome any support from our study abroad offices. In fact, I love any time they help us find students and promote our program. But I recognize that they're also torn between supporting so many programs. And we really are our best advocate and ambassador for our own mm-hmm. programs we've created. We can talk about it. We should talk about it. We should be doing that recruitment piece.
I won't mention programs, but I had the recent experience of giving a dozen or so classroom presentations about one of the faculty-led programs at the university where I work. And one of the 5-minute yeah. presentations. And one of those presentations happened to be in the class of one of the faculty leaders. And the information that he was able to add
right.
is not something that I could have ever captured. And I think it meant so much more to the students to hear that from him mm-hmm. than just the general information that I could provide. And of course, there's, you know, also the other part that occurs to me is, I know that faculty have lots of responsibilities, teaching, research, service, etc. And sometimes they don't feel that they have the time to do what you've just mm-hmm. described. And so sometimes there's, at least with some faculty, there's a tendency to say, that's the study abroad office's job. Mm-hmm. And as someone who works in a study abroad office, sometimes I can appreciate that, but I also understand we're trying to promote study abroad in general and a whole bunch of faculty-led programs, not just the one that this particular mm-hmm. faculty member wants us to do. And so we can put one poster
mm-hmm.
on a bulletin board in every building on campus, mm-hmm. right? And so that one, I mean, we can't plaster the entire board,
yes.
right? And so the limited space that we have can't talk about the details of any particular program. It has to be all of the faculty-led programs or even just more generally study abroad. So,
yeah, and I completely understand that. And that makes a lot of sense. And I think that's why I do think if you're someone who wants to create a program and wants to ensure its success, you have to, I guess that's the other part of that conversation of what should you know before creating a program.
Right, right.
We did mention this earlier, but I think what you should know is that you're not just doing the program that time period you're actually abroad, but it's that full year-long commitment to also promoting your program, letting people know about it, and bringing students into it. Because if you're not doing it, I don't know. I think it's an unfair expectation to think that others should be your program's best advocate. I think that really needs to be you, the person leading the program.
Right. But you also suggested that this has to also be a partnership.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yes. Oh, absolutely. I'm just thinking in terms of the being able to make your program stand out. I think you as a faculty person really should need to be invested in that. But in terms of getting a program going, that's a campus-wide effort.
Yep, for sure. For sure.
Yeah. I could not do this without the support of Nancy Guthrie is our study abroad director at Iowa State for the College of LAS, and my program is housed in that college. And she's amazing, and I would have never gotten to where I am today without her support and help.
Mm-hmm. At a previous university, we had a large study abroad fair and a large number of faculty-led programs, and it was always interesting to see at the fair that the difference in personalities of the various faculty leaders. And there's one in particular that I remember. He would stand in front of the table and he would have a stack of brochures for the program. And as students would walk by, he would hold one out and say, "Do you want to go to New Zealand with me? Do you want to go to Italy with me?"
Are you describing me? Were you at our study abroad fair?
Maybe. I don't know. and then in contrast, there are others who sit behind the table and they're buried in their laptops getting work done. And
I painfully make eye contact with all the students who walk by, much to their discomfort.
Yeah.
But yeah.
Right, because you don't want to make eye contact right away and scare them away. I also worked at a previous institution where we had it wasn't a study abroad fair, it was like a new student event. Mm-hmm. And we had a table there and we had one of those little blow up globes from one of the big insurance companies that works in study abroad. And so seemingly non-threatening way would be to like throw that ball at students. And there were a few that got freaked out by that.
Yeah. But I feel like that would freak people out. Yeah. I would be hesitant to do that, but I do stand in front of the table with my brochure and try to kind of engage students as they walk by.
Yeah. Well, is there anything else you'd like to add?
I just love that we're having this conversation. I think because study abroad is such a, it's such a broad field. It's so diverse in terms of what study abroad international education can look like. I love that you're, connecting us through the podcast and allowing us to explore these topics across different universities and institutions. I think this is great. I think we need more of this. I don't think our world is becoming any less global. I think we're continuing to move in the directions of borders feeling increasingly porous and travel being more accessible, and I think that's great, and how it should be, and so I think it's great to have these conversations about how are we making that possible for our students, and how are we encouraging them to engage with the world outside of their hometown or their university campus and the community they grew up in.
Mm-hmm. And if you had one wish for study abroad professionals, speaking as a faculty leader, what would you like us to know, or what would you like us to do differently or maybe keep doing?
Yeah, no. So I do have one part of study abroad in the field that I think is important for us to continue to look at critically and how we're doing. And that's who we bring into our programs and how we make our programs inclusive and diverse. Mm-hmm. We know that study abroad students in terms of the student field, predominantly white women students study abroad.
Yep.
How are we bringing in students of color? How are we bringing multiracial students in to feel comfortable going on our programs, to feel comfortable thinking about different destinations and what it means to be an African-American person in a Western European country. Is that going to be comfortable? Is that going to be okay? And also for queer and LGBT students, trans students, oh my God, have long faced different barriers to international travel. And so I think one area where we can keep doing the work is to not put the burden on the students to figure out, can I go abroad? Will I be safe with my identity abroad? Mm-hmm. Will the faculty member taking me abroad be inclusive and welcoming of me? Or is it going to be uncomfortable because my identity is different from the one of the majority of the group? I think we as faculty members need to put that conversation out there, and we need to do the work of bringing students in and making them feel seen and valued and important in our mm-hmm. programs. So that we can continue to make study abroad something that all students feel like they're part of, not just the same sort of privileged identities that have long been participants in study abroad programs.
Great. Yeah. Well, thank you so much for your time today. I've really enjoyed this conversation, and I hope that our listeners will find some value in it as well.
Thank you. Me too. Thank you.
The Innovating Faculty-Led Programs podcast and its companion blog is intended to be an engaging, inclusive community for both education abroad professionals and faculty. So regardless of your experience and role with faculty-led programs, I invite you to join the conversation. Let us know your thoughts about today's discussion. How are faculty-led programs a labor of love for you? What do you wish you had known when you started? Do you take your family along with you? If so, how does that impact your role as a faculty leader? How has your experience leading programs abroad translated into the work you do at home? Is there a colleague or department on your campus that is not currently involved in faculty-led programs that you would like to see involved? How would you approach that conversation? What recruitment and marketing strategies have you found to be particularly useful? How are you your program's own best advocate? How have you involved students from past years in those efforts? How do we make our programs more inclusive and diverse? And finally, what topics would you like to hear about on future episodes? To join the conversation about this episode, go to iflp.cc/episode5. Please also feel free to send comments, questions, or suggestions for future episodes to podcast@innovatingfacultyled.com. If you'd like to join me on a future episode, or if you want to suggest someone else as a possible guest, let me know that as well. Until next time, thank you for listening.